Welcome back to the Mind and Fitness Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Eddie Lidenstein. It is Wednesday, March the 18th, 2026. Thank you so much for being here. We've already had 316, if you're a wrestling fan, this week. We've had St. Patrick's Day. I have an Irish flag tattooed on my arm. So congratulations to you and happy 316 and 317 if you celebrate either one of those. Before I get started, I want to make sure that I thank the patrons of the show. If you're interested in supporting the show, throwing a few bucks in the tip jar, go to patreon.com/themindandfitnesspodcast. Want to give a shout out to Emlis, Carolyn, Justin, Mary, Teresa, Albert, Jeff, Julie, Deborah, Elise, Dominic, John, Jason, Irina, Tony, Michael, Christina, Brian, Sarah, Arnie, and Barb. Thank you all so much for supporting the podcast each and every month. And I've been doing a little bit of extra content for the patron page or Patreon page. I've been doing some video updates over the last few days, couple weeks. Got a new microphone that I'm using for that. So there's just doing a little bit of like peek behind the curtain kind of thing that you'll be able to see if you check that out. I did a video this morning, a couple minutes after I dropped the kids off, walking the dogs, going through the pouring rain. So yeah, we'd love to see you over there. Today's show, I'm super excited for you to get a listen to this. Paulina Sobel was introduced to me by Jeannie Colwin, friend of the show. She wrote a book on pain reprocessing therapy designed for teens and kids. And I've said for a long time, like, that's one of the things that I haven't been able to get anybody on here to talk about before. And so it was really great kind of getting to talk to her about that and why it's of interest to her and things like that. So I'll link to the book, which you can get on Amazon. And I'll also link to her organization, Get Well Body, which is getwellbody.com. And then the Pain Reprocessing Therapy Center as well. So without further ado, here is Paulina Noble and I talking PRT, PRT for teens, PRT for kids. Let's take a listen. Welcome back to the Mind and Fitness Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Eddie Lindenstein. With me from the other side of the country, might as well be the other side of the planet, is Paulina Sobel from the Pain Reprocessing Therapy Center. Are you there? Can you hear me?
Yes. I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. You were introduced to me by a friend of the show, Jeannie Colwin, and so it's nice to be able to chat with you. I did a video this morning for people who subscribe on Patreon, and I had said that, hey, like, the thing that I have been saying for probably 3 or 4 years on this podcast now is the thing that's missing. I haven't had the opportunity to talk to a person that has like a specific interest in like anything that's not adult. So like teens or kids or anything like that. So I'm really excited to have that be kind of your forte, because you recently did a project specific to pain reprocessing therapy, PRT for teens, right?
Yes, okay. Exactly. We just released a workbook that's specific to adolescents and teens.
Awesome. Okay. Before we dive into that, because I think that's going to take probably the bulk of the time that we have here today, I'm always curious on backgrounds and schooling and things like that, because there was a time where maybe you were in middle school or high school, you're like, I don't even know what I want to do for a living. And maybe it was even in college where you were still saying that. But talk about your background in schooling and how this became of interest to you.
Sure. So yes, exactly what you described is true. I went to USC in California. I studied cognitive science. So I always had an interest in psychology, but I never knew what I wanted to do growing up. Even in college, I had a really hard time choosing a major. I went in undecided. One of my roommates actually was studying cognitive science, and it sounded interesting to me, and I had to choose something. So I chose it. And it was great. When I graduated, I did not know what I wanted to do. I spoke to a lot of professionals in different fields, and I found that I always connected with people that did, you know, mental health work, whether that was with adults or children, but some sort of psychology-based work. I always had the richest conversations with them. So I just sort of took that and ran with it. I applied to USC again for a master's in social work, and I ended up going through with that program, which was an incredible decision because through my clinical internships, I was sort of introduced into what I do now, which is treating chronic pain that is based in the brain. So we don't, the treatment that I use is called pain reprocessing therapy, and it's not specifically for people with structural issues or underlying disease processes that cause their pain. It's more so based in neural pathways in the brain that have learned and remembered pain, and how fear signaling influences pain. And so we treat chronic pain through a mental health standpoint, through psychotherapy, really. And that's what pain reprocessing therapy is. It's a talk therapy.
Do you come from the... like the Alan Gordon, Christy Weepy learning tree? Like, is that kind of where you came from?
Exactly. Yes. Okay. I worked at the Pain Psychology Center. I worked under Alan Gordon, and Christy was involved at the Pain Psychology Center as well for many years. So yes.
I'm not sure if you're a Marvel fan, but Alan's kind of like the last of my Infinity Stones for this podcast of people that I have not had on that I've really, really wanted to get on. And he actually introduced me to Christy. He was like, I can't, this was back when he was in the like deepest part of the Boulder back pain study, commuting a couple times a week when we were sort of talking about this. So this was last decade, which is, you know, a long time ago. But do you mind me asking, when did you graduate from, you got an MSW, is that, or wait, yeah, a master's in social work, an MSW, right?
Yes.
What year did you graduate with?
In 2020.
Okay.
In COVID times.
Okay. So, well, okay. So that's a really interesting thing too. I guess maybe talk about the nuance of, because my daughter was a kindergartner and a first grader when that happened. That's a lot different than being in a master's program trying to learn about that. Because in fact, Christy actually came on this podcast maybe 2 weeks into the start of the pandemic to sort of talk about the experience of being somebody involved in the mental health field while all of this is going on. Is there anything specific that you can speak to as far as like being trained or going to school for that stuff during that time that jumps out to you at all?
I mean, it was crazy, but it was just probably similar experience to everyone else. Had I been an undergrad, I think I would have been severely disappointed that this was happening to me at this time. In graduate school, it was fine. We just took our classes on Zoom. We saw our patients on Zoom for our internships. We had our supervision on Zoom. Everything just became virtual.
Yeah.
But it was okay. It was fine. At the time, we were working on building out the Pain Reprocessing Therapy Training Center. And our initial idea was that this was going to be an in-person service, an in-person training. And this all got switched up when COVID came around. But it ended up being a positive in that sense, because we realized we could reach so many more people with so many less barriers if we conducted this online, which we had really considered doing before. So in that way, it was positive, but you know.
Now, Alan has worked a lot with Howard Schubiner over the years. And Howard Schubiner, one interesting thing, I'd love to kind of get your take on this, and you know, you're not speaking for him, but one interesting thing that I find from his work, and something that I've had because my daughter's kind of taken an interest in this, my older daughter has started taking an interest just in this topic. And one of the things that I've had a difficult time being able to explain to her is that for a lot of people, anxiety, depression are in the same, they're called something different, but they're very much in the same category when it comes to chronic as physical pain in a lot of ways. Now, Howard Schubiner wrote one book called Unlearn Your Pain, and then he had a subsequent book called Unlearn Your Anxiety and Depression, but the content was virtually the same. It was almost exactly the same thing. Do you find yourself using similar techniques in pain reprocessing therapy for somebody with anxiety, depression, as you do with, I have this chronic back pain that won't go away and it's been 10 years?
Yes, that's a great question. And yes, so there's sort of a fear pain loop that can feed chronic pain. So there's something that's triggering our fear, and that might be fear of bodily damage, fear that there's something wrong with us, because why else would we have this pain? But it's also general fears in our life that might be unrelated to the pain, but are in our social life or school or work or environment or family or whatever. And when someone is very anxious, they might be, or they are experiencing depression, they might be experiencing the world through this lens of danger. They might be looking at everything that they do or everyone they come in contact with as though it could be potentially dangerous to them. And that then feeds over into how they experience sensations in their body. And if you feel a sensation and you think it could be potentially dangerous, or your brain is almost primed toward a potential threat, then more likely than not, that neutral sensation will become painful because of that added layer of fear. So there's definitely a correlation. There's a lot of comorbidity that I see in my patients who have chronic pain, that they'll also experience anxiety or also experience depression or both. And I do treat them in a very similar way.
Finish your thought.
I was just going to say, there's a lot of appropriate treatments for anxiety and depression outside of PRT alone. But with chronic pain, you're trying to understand that this stimulus is actually safe and experience the physical sensation of it in a new way. And I do something similar when it comes to anxiety. You know, is this trigger as life-threatening as you're making it out to be? Hopefully not. And so that's the cognitive piece of figuring that out. And then somatically, well, how do you experience that anxiety in your body? And can we have you tolerate that sensation, knowing that it's actually safe, or it's not as dangerous as you thought it was?
What is the, and maybe you don't get asked this question when you're working with somebody, but what does the science suggest, or what does your training and education suggest in terms of that notion of like, why a certain part of the body is picked by the brain as being, here's the place that I'm going to attack for pain, whether it be the back or the shoulder or the wrist or the, you know, the knee or the ankle. Cause like, it seems to be like everybody's kind of got something at some point, but like what makes that spot be the spot that's picked in your, and maybe this is just an opinion question from you.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good question because I don't really know what the science would say behind that, or if there is any hard data to explain that. Sometimes we see these kind of funny symptoms where like someone doesn't stand up for themselves and they really need to put their foot down and they can't, and they have foot pain. So sometimes we see something like that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, generally there might be some initial injury, some acute injury that does heal, but your brain doesn't really process that part of your body is now safe. So the pain might continue in that same area where it started because of something structural.
Yeah.
That can happen pretty often. Or it might be that there's a social contagion almost. Someone in your family, someone in your life has really debilitating back pain. And so you've always been afraid of having that as well.
Yep.
And that fear is like a self-fulfilling prophecy. So sometimes that can happen.
One of the things that I laugh about this now, and my mom doesn't listen to this. So if you have an opinion on this that you feel might be negative, my mom won't take it personally. One of the things that she said to me for a long time is, I'm turning 40 next week. And one of the things that she said to me for a long time is, your dad had two hip replacements. Maybe it's worth just going to get some imaging done on your hips. They don't hurt. Maybe it's worth going to get some imaging done on your hips, you know, just to see if there's something going on. Do you have an opinion on something like that? Like, just as, I guess, as somebody who the social contagion idea is what made me think about that, right? Or even like, that seems like it's a fairly close cousin to like the power of suggestion, right? Like, oh, my elbow hurts. And then the person next to me, their elbow starts hurting. You know what I mean?
Right. Yes, I was just looking. There's a study about normal abnormalities, and I do believe that there's something in there about hips, but I'm not sure if I have it. But, you know, oftentimes we'll see something on imaging, or a doctor would see something on imaging, and it's not necessarily the cause of the pain itself. It might be an incidental finding. So if there's a fear that there's something wrong, and then you see on the scan, well, there is some degeneration, right? Or there is something that's off, that's imperfect. It might just be a normal sign of aging, but we can take that and run with it.
Yeah.
And oftentimes use that as a causation for the pain. And when we see that, we often, our fear ramps up. So then our pain ramps up.
Yeah.
And maybe if you get a scan and it's completely clean, maybe that's all you needed to make your pain go away in that same vein.
Yeah. By the time that people get to you, I imagine like they must have an understanding of, hey, like my pain is more than likely a mind-body problem, or is that not the case? By the time that you have your first session or an intro session or something with somebody?
Yes, I would say that most times people do have full medical workups, maybe even for years, they've taken the medical route before coming to us, which makes a lot of sense. It's biological that we associate physical pain with physical damage. Oftentimes people will say, you know, I don't know what else it could be. So, you know, if I can't find anything wrong and nothing physical is helping me, I guess I might as well give this a shot. So it might be that, like almost more coming from a place of desperation. I don't know what else to possibly do. Or yes, they've done a lot of their own research and read the books and seen the studies and connected with the assessment criteria that we have for neuroplastic pain, and they're more bought in.
Dr. David Schechter, one of the things that he told me years ago is that like one of the biggest challenges of his role is around doubt, like the doubt of the patient, the doubt, like he tells them, this is a mind body issue, or maybe even the doubt, like somebody, maybe they buy it, but then 3 months go by and the problem's not completely solved. And then the doubt starts to enter their mind too. Do you mind sharing a little bit about maybe doubt in your experience in this field, either working with people or, something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. So Dr. David Schechter is great. He actually wrote the foreword for our workbook.
Oh, cool. Okay.
So it was great to work with him. So I think that skepticism is very normal and is okay. Mm-hmm. Someone might not be all the way bought in, or they might have some doubts in the back of their mind. Well, what if the doctors miss something? I think that it's only human to have that. And it just shows that you care about yourself and you want to recover and you want to do the right thing for yourself.
Yeah.
And that's okay. And that can be powerful. And you don't need to completely get rid of that in order to start treatment. But we do want to find a baseline level of safety. So if this person is convinced that there must be something going on, right? And there's no other way that they could have this pain, you know, there must be something going on structurally, then it's difficult to have them lean into their body with any semblance of safety. You know, so we need to find what can make them feel safe in their life, even have pockets of safety where they can maybe practice somatic tracking or use these different somatic techniques. But generally, we want to create evidence, right? I don't want to just tell this person they're safe. Oh, I think you have neuroplastic pain, so believe me. I want them to really believe it themselves because they've seen it, because they've seen their pain increase with stress, because they've seen, you know, they don't notice their pain very much when they're engaged in something they really authentically enjoy.
Yeah.
Because there's so much inconsistency, because their pain always hurts when they sit, but one day they sat and it wasn't there. You know, any of that pieces of those pieces of evidence that we can find is what I want the patient to lean on. And I can give them the education, and that's great. But they need their own authentic, like internal understanding. So that's what I try to build with them.
Do you find yourself having to do more of the, I don't know if convincing is the right word here, selling, convincing, like whatever we want to say. I'm curious always about the, I look a lot of times at like the statistics or analytics of like this podcast, what age groups are listening, what genders are listening. Do you tend to find any sort of a difference in demographics of people that maybe tend to understand and accept this kind of thought process, you know, like a totally physical Western medical model thought versus what you're working with people as far as age goes and as far as gender goes, just in your experience?
Probably the older population has a harder time understanding it.
Okay.
Which I get, because yeah, it's so new. I mean, when I did my internship at the Pain Psychology Center, I had never heard of pain being treated mm-hmm. in that way. That was the first time I was introduced to it. And I think an older population might see it as a little bit more woo-woo or wonky than it really is. Yeah. It really is based in science and data. It's not only belief or only an opinion. Gender, no, I don't really see a difference.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that the younger population, but adults as well. I mean, I work with 40, 50-year-olds. I think they can certainly buy in and understand. They just probably haven't thought of their pain being created or influenced in this way before. But Nate, I had never either.
Just so I'm clear, this is the last week I'm in my 30s. Did you just say 40 and 50-year-olds are in the older? Is that what
you
said?
No.
Okay.
I mean,
okay.
I would say more. I don't know the number breakdown, but maybe 70s and above.
Yeah.
Say, you know, this is such a new age idea that I didn't grow up and I'm not comfortable with this.
Okay. So you said something that was really interesting a second ago. You had not heard of this stuff prior to getting to the pain psychology. What took you there then? How did you end up there?
So for my second year clinical internship in social work school, we were able to apply and pick where we wanted to work. Mm-hmm. Our first year, we were just assigned. So I worked with teenagers. My first year at a school, it was formerly incarcerated youth. It was difficult, but such an incredible learning experience. I actually ended up really getting so much out of it and really liking it. But I wanted to do something different. And so I just browsed the list of internship placements. There were at least 100, I think, through USC. And I saw the Pain Psychology Center and I did some research and I was so fascinated by this idea. And I started reading up on it and I thought, wow, this really makes sense to me. Yeah. I could understand at a base level that there was a mind-body connection, that I would get headaches when I was stressed out, you know, that I would get stomach aches when I had a big test in school. And so really at a base level made sense to me. And so I just really wanted to work there and I wanted to understand what model they used. So I ended up getting placed there, which was great, but I really had never thought about it. I had never treated myself in that way or looked for that sort of treatment before. And once I started treating patients, I realized how powerful this work was.
Well, it's the perfect conduit about kind of the main thing that I want to chat about a little bit. So talk about this, like what prompted you to write a PRT book for teens? Because I think that's, again, it's like, this is episode approximately 430 or so. Nobody's ever been in here that's talked about specific to teens. So talk about that.
Okay, good. Well, that's really why. I have a private practice called Well Body Psychotherapy. We had quite a number of kids and teens and their parents reaching out to us for treatment. And sometimes people will want treatment and sometimes they'll just want resources. And I feel like there's a decent amount of resources out there for adults, and there's not as many for a younger generation. And, you know, there's a wonderful pain reprocessing therapy workbook for adults, which I will send to people and I'll refer. But we wanted more resources for teenagers. So we thought we would do it ourselves because we didn't think it already existed. And like you said, you know, we've had so many episodes and this population hasn't been as focused on, but a lot of them still experience chronic pain and need the same treatment that the rest of us get.
Maybe I heard wrong or misunderstanding or misremembering. Give me like an age. Is this like the literal sense 13 to 19, or talk about the age range that this is applicable for?
Yeah, I would say that it could be younger, especially if you're using it alongside a parent or caregiver, which we do encourage because we find that, you know, you believe you are as capable as your parent makes you feel you are. So we want this language to land with the parents as well. But I would say even younger, maybe 11, if they're working with a parent, could utilize this book up till 17. Anyone could. Appropriate range.
Yeah. Well, I think it's good you say like with a parent, because one thing that struck me in Alan's book and also in Dr. Schubiner's book is the use of, and maybe not a super ramped up kind, but that like use of like, what is, I don't remember the acronym, intensive short-term psychodynamic therapy. Is that a term? That's the thing, right? Some of it seems to be really, really intense. And so I don't know if a kid that's under 13, is that the best, like, does that, is that a good, you, cause I mean, you tell me, like, is that what some of the workbook or work with kids in that younger demographic is designed to be? It feels like it should be gentler, but I don't know. I don't do this.
It is gentler. No, yeah, we don't use ISTDP. That's not part of our workbook. And that's not something I use with children or teens. I feel like it is pretty intense.
Yeah. What have you uncovered as you've kind of delved more into the teen adolescence thing? Maybe that's different than true. Or like what fascinates you about it? Like kind of talk about, I guess, that as being your specialty in choosing that. Other than that, there weren't a lot of resources for kids or for adolescents that are dealing with this kind of stuff. But I'm fascinated to know about things that might be unique or different to them that where I've had the therapists on here, they're typically working with people that are in their 30s, 40s, 50s or above.
Mm-hmm. I would say what we found that teens struggle with and maybe what will put them into a state or place of chronic pain in the first place could be different triggers than adults. But I mean, maybe a different setting. They're in school, they're in high school. There can be a lot of social anxiety, social pressure that for some of us is more recovered when we grow up, not for everyone, but there could be a lot of fear of embarrassment or fear of judgment or fear of being different. There's can be this higher baseline worry that can cause avoidance of these situations. And when there's more avoidance, there can be more uncertainty, more self-fulfilling that this situation is actually dangerous. And so I should keep avoiding it. And that's a really similar pattern that plays with chronic pain, you know, or this movement or this activity is dangerous for my body, for my pain. Mm-hmm. It's going to cause more pain. So I'm just going to avoid it. But that sends the message to the brain that it really is dangerous and that there's something physical going on in your body that needs to be fixed. I think there can be also a lot of high achieving. I think the pressure on teens is so great. I mean, I definitely felt this when I was in high school that it was the hardest time of my life. I now have started multiple businesses. I have a graduate degree. Yeah. I have a child. I have a 6-month-old. Yeah. I don't find any of that as hard as I found high school.
Wow. Okay.
It was so difficult. It was so much pressure. It was not enough time. It was not enough sleep. You know, there was so much, I keep saying pressure. I don't know what other word to be a high achiever. And I think when you are perfectionistic like that and you have a strong fear of disappointing others or disappointing yourself, and there's a lot of academic or athletic pressure to perform in a certain way, that can cause chronic pain that can put you in this state that makes you a lot more susceptible and sensitive to living with chronic pain because your level of fear and intensity is so high. And so that threat gauge is attuned pretty high, pretty sensitive.
Did you play sports as a teen or a kid?
I did dance.
You did dance. Okay. That seems like a pressure cooker of a sport, yes. The cheerleading, the gymnastics, the dance, like all that stuff seems like I took my older daughter and I, we went and we saw the University of Washington go against Sacramento State for women's gymnastics on Friday. And all I kept thinking was some of these are, you know, they're 22-year-old soon to be graduates, but some are 18-year-old freshmen. And the amount of, they all seemed happy and they were pumping each other up and all this stuff. But I was just telling her like, that seems like among the most stressful things to do, especially at that level, you know, being in the Big Ten conference and all that. I'm curious. So there's a ton of parents that listen to this show. One of the things I've coached girls soccer forever. We start our 10th season tomorrow, or I start my 10th season coaching tomorrow. So I have 16 preteen girls that I coach. What sort of things, to parents, but also like, the high achieving, the pressure that kids are putting on themselves, all that kind of stuff. What sort of things can adults, parents, but coaches and things like that too, and you know, it could be aunts and uncles or whatever. What sort of things can we do as people to aid or help our particularly young females? Because we only have daughters. I only coach girls, so like this is my environment. Is there any sort of wisdom that you can volley to us to maybe help alleviate some of that or work with that for kids and teens and tweens?
Mm-hmm. So I mean, I think that the answer is partially taking the pressure off of them and allowing for imperfections. Although I also find that to be self-imposed oftentimes by the teen, maybe even more than their parent. But if their parent is doubling down on it, maybe to let up on them a little bit.
Yeah.
I think that when you're a teen, whatever you're going through feels like the most important, biggest thing in the world. And you don't have the foresight to see that in a few years or a few months or days, this won't matter so much.
Yeah.
So I think if parents can give that sort of, you know, longer term outcome for the child. But when it comes to chronic pain, the messages that caregivers have will very much impact the patient. So helping this child or teen to understand what is going on with them, what is going on in their body, that they are actually safe, that they don't have to push themselves too much, but there's sort of a graded exposure of not avoiding everything, right? Not staying home from school every day, but can we find a way to get you back into school or social life or sports, academics, whatever it is, in a way that feels a little bit more controlled and a little bit more safe. And so that's some of the work and the activities that we'll have in the workbook is, instead of all avoidance, can we slowly move back into this? And I think parents can be very helpful there. Like, what is the one next step we can take? We don't have to take 10 steps forward, but let's just take one at a time. And it's just reassurance. I think when your parent or a trusted adult reassures you, you feel more confident immediately. But when, you know, these parents, I think, are coming from a very good place. They are very good parents for wanting to protect their child and not wanting their child to be in pain and letting them stay out of everything so that they feel better. But the hard part is that avoidance is not actually so helpful when it comes to recovering from chronic pain.
Is the workbook designed to be like, do a page a day? Like, what's sort of the design or the, you know, like the instructional design of it?
Take it at your own pace, but even, you know, a chapter every week, I would say, could be appropriate. Mm-hmm. There's also exercises in there that you can keep coming back to when we have audio tools that you can follow along with.
Yeah.
So those, you know, whatever somatic tracking exercises or positive sensation exercises land with you, you can come back to those as often as you need, whether that's every day or before you go into a feared activity, when you need some anxiety regulation. Take from it what, you know, best serves you.
It is 5 out of 5 on Amazon, by the way. I was about to say, hey, where do you get this thing? But yes, it is 5 out of 5 on Amazon, and you're on the buy line, and that's super cool. Where can people find you online, or if they like listening? Oh, and then also, because you're on the East Coast, do you only work with people in office? Or are you working with people remotely? Like, because I know there's some complications or whatever when it comes to therapy and people that are in different states and stuff like that. Can you talk through that a little bit?
Yeah. So I work with people remotely. I do not have an office at the moment. And the best place to find me is through either the Pain Reprocessing Therapy Center. So that is really our training center for professionals that want to learn more about pain reprocessing therapy. We hope to launch a course specific to children and teens. So if you're some sort of healthcare practitioner that works with that population, that might be a really appropriate training for you. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, my practice is Well Body Psychotherapy. So that's where I see patients, and I have a wonderful team of 14, I believe, coaches and therapists around the country. So if you're looking for individual treatment, we can match you through Well Body. And if you just go on those websites, there's a contact form where you can reach me. So it's painreprocessingtherapy.com, and WellBody is getwellbody.com.
All right. I'm going to link both of those, and then I'll link the book too on Amazon. Paulina, thank you so much for being here. I said I was going to say this before we start, but don't hang up. But thank you for being here. I'll link those things on there. Really appreciate what you're doing. I think it's awesome to have a resource like this out there for people in the community and for kids and teens.
Great. Thank you so much.